This is Ni'ima Novetzky from alatorah.org. This Torah cast will focus on the sacrificial system, questioning why Hashem chose this mode of service rather than any other as the primary means of worship. Is animal sacrifice really the best way to seek forgiveness, offer thanksgiving, or otherwise connect to Hashem? How does it compare to prayer? Finally, what does offering a gift to God do for the person bringing it, and what effect, if any, does it have on Hashem? Given the significant number of chapters in the Torah devoted to the laws of the sacrificial service, it's natural to assume that sacrifices are viewed in a favorable light. The fact that offerings are referred to as a reach nichoach l'Hashem, a pleasant fragrance to Hashem, or litzono lifnei Hashem, a willing sacrifice before God, would also appear to support this notion. As such, it's somewhat surprising that several statements of the prophets appear to question the value of sacrificial worship. Yeshayahu, for example, presents Hashem as stating, Lama li rozevchechem, what need have I of your sacrifices? Yirmiyahu 7:22 goes a step further, appearing to question even whether Hashem ever commanded the children of Israel to bring sacrifices at all. Ki lo dibarti et avotechem velo tzivitim biyom hotzi otam me'eretz Mitzrayim al divrei olav azavach. For I spoke not to your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. How can such statements be reconciled with the commands in the Torah? What do they reveal about Hashem's attitude towards the sacrificial service? In trying to understand the purpose and value of the sacrificial system, it's helpful to also analyze the specifics of the sacrificial process itself. Though the Torah does not provide reasons for the various details, these presumably can shed light on the nature of the commandment as a whole. We are commanded to bring sacrifices from cattle, sheep, goats, turtle doves, and pigeons, but not other living creatures. Is there any significance to this choice of animals? Part of the sacrificial process involves that the individual bringing the offering place his hands on it before slaughtering it. What does this act of smicha meant to represent? Third, how are we to understand the various blood-related rites? Why is the blood of the animal sprinkled on the altar and prohibited from consumption? Finally, why is it prohibited to bring a leavened offering or one sweetened with honey? And why, conversely, is it an obligation to have salt accompany every sacrifice? In trying to determine both the purpose of the sacrificial system and whether it is an ideal form of worship, commentators are influenced not just by textual considerations, but also by their positions on a number of other philosophical issues. These include, 1, their attitude towards prayer, 2, whether they believe that Torah's laws must represent in an ideal and be inherently valuable, or if they think that some laws might simply be addressing human needs and nature, and 3, how they view the eternal character of Torah. Must every law be equally relevant and necessary for every generation, or might some be directed more at one particular era? Let's survey an array of approaches to these questions, starting with those who do not see much inherent value in the sacrificial system, but instead view it as merely a corrective to negative beliefs. The most well-known proponent of this position is the 12th century Torah giant, Maimonides. Rambam, in his Moreh Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed, maintains that sacrifices are not an ideal form of worship and were instituted only as a means to wean the nation away from idolatry. He explains that even though animal sacrifice was not Hashem's desired mode of worship, Hashem nonetheless permitted it, since that was the form of worship to which the nation was accustomed. Living among idolaters who served their gods through sacrifices in temples, the Israelites would have found it unfathomable had such practices been forbidden. Thus, knowing that the people cannot change their behavior from one extreme to another overnight, Hashem maintained some aspects of the service with which the people were familiar, but ensured that they sacrificed to Him alone. As such, he hoped to gradually wean the Israelites away from idolatrous practices. Rambam suggests that many of the details of the sacrificial service were instituted with this goal in mind. For example, Hashem commanded that the nation sacrifice specifically sheep, goats, and cattle, since it was these animals which were most revered and worshipped by other nations. Slaughtering them served to underscore the impotence of these so-called gods. Similarly, since idolaters viewed the blood of animals as impure, and only those who wanted to communicate with demons would eat of it, the Torah, in contrast, has blood play a role in atonement and purification and prohibits all from consuming it. Finally, as idol worshippers normally sweetened their sacrifices and accompanied them with leavened bread, Hashem commanded the opposite, prohibiting leaven and honey, and prescribing that sacrifices be offered with salt. As evidence for this understanding of sacrifices, one might point to Vayikra 17's command, "V'lo yisbechu od et zivcheihem la'se'irim," which suggests that Hashem obligated the nation to bring him sacrifices to prevent their offering of them to demons. Rambam further points to the prophetic statements that we noted previously, which declare that Hashem has no desire for the nation's sacrifices, claiming that these prove that the prophets agreed that Hashem's motive in commanding sacrifices was only for the people to attain belief in him, not that the sacrifices had any inherent worth. Rambam's attitude towards sacrifices is consistent with his view that prayer is the primary form of service to Hashem. He reads the verse, "Va'avadtem et Hashem Elokichem," and you shall serve Hashem your God, as a command to serve Hashem through prayer specifically, and does not think that it refers to sacrifices at all. For him, an intellectual, service of Hashem relates to speech and thought rather than actions. Rambam is further consistent in suggesting that several of the Torah's laws might come to address the reality of people's nature and needs and are not necessarily representative of an ideal. Elsewhere, too, he allows for the possibility that certain commandments, such as kashrut or the incense in the Mishkan, could be simply practical advice or concessions to human foibles. The 13th century Spanish commentator Ramban Nachmanides strongly disagrees with Rambam, challenging him on a number of fronts. For example, he points to characters in Tanakh such as Cain and Hevel or Noach who brought sacrifices already before idolatry existed. Ostensibly, they were neither imitating nor reacting to idolatrous practices, but instead found something intrinsically positive about worshiping Hashem in this manner. Rambam further questions the Rambam from the phrase describing sacrifices as an isher riach nichoach l'Hashem, since this suggests that the sacrifices were pleasing to Hashem and not simply a means to negate idolatry. Finally, he points out that the Torah devotes more space to sacrificial procedures than to any other law. If, as the Rambam suggests, they are not inherently significant, why dedicate almost an entire sefer to their laws? Ramban thus presents a diametrically opposed view of sacrifices, seeing them as inherently positive and an ideal way to worship Hashem. He suggests that they invite divine inspiration on a national level and views them as a prerequisite for Hashem's presence to dwell in the Mikdash. As evidence, he points to the fact that the divine presence filled the tabernacle only after the bringing of the offerings on the eighth day of the consecration ceremony. He further notes that the word korban means to come close, and as such, the word itself hints to the sacrifice's purpose, to bring humans closer to the divine. Ramban, though, does not explain why receiving divine inspiration was contingent specifically on animal sacrifice. In ancient times, meals often accompanied and served to seal a covenant. As such, it's possible that the sacrifices were meant to constitute such a meal. If the Mishkan was meant to be an extension of the revelation at Sinai, the bringing of sacrifices could be seen as a continuous renewal of the Sinaitic covenant and the accompanying revelation of Hashem. Ramban's attitude towards sacrifices is consistent with his view of prayer as only a secondary form of service to God. He claims that the biblical obligation to pray applies only in times of distress. Prayers at other times are only rabbinically mandated. The highest form of service to Hashem is via sacrifices, not through mere words alone, but also via more concrete actions. For Ramban, then, sacrifices, like the rest of Hashem's Torah, are indicative of the ideal, not a concession to human nature. The various prophetic statements that seem to question their worth are not really opposing the sacrificial system, only arguing that bringing sacrifices without keeping the terms of Hashem's covenant is of no meaning or benefit. Rav David Zvi Hoffman, a 19th to 20th century German commentator, agrees with Ramban's positive evaluation of sacrificial worship. He too views them as a means of connecting to the divine, but in a very different way. He suggests that sacrifices are meant to symbolize that a person and all his possessions belong to and depend upon Hashem. In offering a sacrifice, the individual expresses his total dedication, surrender, and unconditional obedience to God. Rav Hoffman views Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, as the prototype for all future sacrifices. In demonstrating his willingness to sacrifice his son, Abraham displayed his total submission to Hashem's will and complete obedience to do as asked, even to the point of death. In the end, though, the ram served as Yitzhak's substitute and became the model for all sacrifices. In offering a sacrifice to Hashem, every individual makes the same declaration as Abraham, that one is submitting oneself in totality to God. Rav Hoffman explains how each sacrifice aims to accomplish these goals. An olah, which is completely consumed on the altar, demonstrates the individual's willingness to give up his entire being to Hashem. A mincha, brought from flour, the staple of man's sustenance, represents the dedication of all one's possessions to the service of God. Shlamim, from the root shalem, or whole, symbolizes man's cognizance that he's whole only because of Hashem's providence. Finally, the sin offerings help man who has veered from total submission and obedience to correct his ways and get back on track. Some of the details of the sacrificial service can be seen in the same light. Rav Hoffman understands smicha to be the authorizing of another to take one's place or serve as one's representative. The person bringing the sacrifice places his hand on the animal to authorize him to act as his substitute in giving himself to God. The sprinkling of the animal's blood can then symbolize man's life and soul, which he dedicates to Hashem. One last approach to sacrifices stands someplace in the middle of those just mentioned, viewing sacrifices neither as a concession to human beliefs nor as an ideal way of connecting to the divine. It rather understands all sacrifices to be a necessary corrective to sin. Though all would agree that the chatat and asham offerings serve a role in the atonement process, this position is unique in suggesting that all the other sacrifices do as well. With regards to the olah offering, the verse states, "V'nirtzalo l'chaper alav," it shall be accepted for him to make atonement, suggesting that it too can atone. Rabag, a 14th century Provençal commentator, adds that despite the silence in the text, the mincha and shlamim offerings also come to atone. As evidence, he points to the rebuke to Eli's sons, where they are told, "Im yitkaper avon beit Eli b'zavach uv'mincha," the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be expiated with a sacrifice or mincha forever. This suggests that normally a mincha or shlamim can also help expiate for sins. How though do sacrifices accomplish this? Ramban suggests that the sacrifice serves as a substitute or redemption for the sinner, as it is killed in the individual's stead. In watching the animal slaughtered, the person is forced to recognize that it should have been his blood which was spilled had it not been for Hashem's mercy. The impact of this experience should help prevent him from sinning further. Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, in contrast, asserts that the atonement process is necessary to enable people to start afresh. If there was no way of cleansing oneself from sin, people would be less likely to be wary of future sins, thinking that they would remain stained regardless. Thus, knowing that one's slate has been wiped clean provides an incentive to subsequently remain pure. This, though, does not account for why the process must involve specifically animal slaughter, rather than a recitation of Al-Chaitz or the like. Rabag opines that had a person simply confessed his sins or repented in his heart, he would not think that this sufficed to achieve penance. So therefore, Hashem provided an active ritual. Words alone do not affect a person in the way that an active process does. This approach explains many details of the sacrificial service as being related to this atonement process. Rabag suggests that the laying of hands on the animal signifies the individual's transferring of his transgressions onto the animal. The salt, which lasts forever, is symbolic of the fact that sacrifices serve as an eternal covenant of atonement. And the prohibition of blood stems from the fact that it is supposed to represent the soul of the sinner. If so, it's logical why it cannot be eaten by the individual bringing the sacrifice. This position might explain that the seemingly negative attitude of the prophets toward sacrifices is simply Hashem's expression that he preferred that the nation not sin to begin with, and thus not need to offer sacrifices for atonement. In fact, the 16th century Italian commentator Sforno suggests that the entire system was not part of Hashem's initial plan and only came into effect after the sin of the golden calf, when its necessity was proven. According to him, then, Yirmiyahu's words that when leaving Egypt, Hashem never commanded burnt offerings or sacrifices can be taken at face value. At the time of the Exodus, Hashem had not desired that there be a sacrificial system. He was hoping that it would not be necessary. In summary, we have seen those who view sacrifices as an antidote to idolatry, and those who conversely read them as a means of connecting to the divine. Yet others see them as a necessary and crucial part of the atonement process. Of course, as these are not necessarily mutually exclusive, it's also possible that the sacrificial system serves multiple purposes, and that all three approaches are correct. How might our relationship to Hashem differ if we were to replace or at least supplement our prayers with sacrifices? How does active giving, laying forth of one's own money and time to invest in a sacrifice, compare to mere words? Are words not cheap in comparison? And if a picture is worth a thousand words, how might participating in the slaughter of an animal who stands as our substitute affect us? Would we be as quick to sin the next time around? For more on this topic and other topics related to Parashat Vayikra, please visit alatorah.org.